From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about why it is some people kill themselves. The research scientist and writer Jesse Baring is our guest. He has a book that explores the science, the psychology at the heart of suicide. He puts it this way in his book: knowing the psychology and the mechanics of suicide could help stop someone or make them rethink the unthinkable. We'll be right back.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Every year around the world, a million people kill themselves. And a lot more than that try. In his new book about suicide, the science writer Jesse Baring says that's probably a conservative estimate. There are a lot of reasons why people don't report it or even want to talk about it. And there are all kinds of issues that could lead someone to end their life or want to. Psychiatric conditions and mood disorders, of course, that accounts for most. But there's also genetics. There's also a chain of events, tragedy, failure, bullying. In his book, Baring focuses on the science behind the suicides of otherwise normal folks, as he puts it. People who may feel depressed on occasion or people who are overwhelmed from time to time by something in their life. The title of the book is Suicidal, but it's the subtitle that really gets at it pretty succinctly, Why We Kill Ourselves. Now, we should mention, for those who might be thinking about ending their own life, there are people you can talk to. On our website, we have a list of resources for people who need help. There are national and local crisis numbers on the website, including the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 1-800-273-8255, or you can text the Lifeline at 741-741. Jesse Baring is the director at the Center for Science Communication at the University of Otago in New Zealand. He joined us from Radio New Zealand in Dunedin on the country's South Island. I guess we need to begin with something you say right up front in the book, that there was this beautiful oak tree behind your house in upstate New York. And you explain that, this is how you explain it. You explain that it regularly beckoned to you. In fact, you thought about it, and I'll quote you here, as the perfect place to hang yourself. I wanted to start there if we could. You write about being haunted by that not altogether displeasing image of your own corpse hanging from that tree. Can we just talk about why begin there and why come up front with this sort of personal dimension to the story? I wanted to start there if we could.
Well, I suppose I wanted to just informed the reader that I was like them, or that I was like somebody that they knew, rather than a scientist putting suicidal people under the microscope. I've been there personally myself before. I know what these experiences are like. This was me sort of gesturing that I would be holding their hand along this very difficult journey. So yeah, I wanted that introduction to be a bit disarming, give people the comfort of knowing that they could share their thoughts openly, that they could begin this conversation with somebody that they know has also been in a very similar place before. And for me, that meant, you know, sharing some relatively uncomfortable emotions or impulses that I've experienced myself.
Mm. It's interesting you mentioned when you were experiencing success, lots of exciting success in your work, for example. But then there was this contrast going on between your private and your public life, where these moments where you were deeply unhappy. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because I think that contrast is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had, I think, from all objective criteria, a relatively successful life, and I've had a lot of things to be very grateful for and to celebrate. On the other hand, I think the emotion of happiness has been elusive to me for quite a long time. I don't know if I've ever experienced, well, I do have fleeting bouts of happiness, profound joy, you know, when I, sometimes with my partner, sometimes yeah. with my pets, you know, traveling, those types of things. But it's certainly not a permanent state. And I don't think I've been in that sort of permanent state of happiness since I was, I don't know, 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just simply a consequence of being human, really. And that's one of the messages that I'm trying to convey in this book, that the illusion of sort of this permanent state of happiness is just that, that all we can really do is try to maximize those moments of joy and live for them. But it is unrealistic to think that we will ever reach this permanent or perfect state of bliss.
So how much of it was your own interest in science, and how much of it was your own sort of personal interest? I guess they both came together to really want to critically analyze all of this.
Yeah, it's hard for me to separate the yeah. two, really, because yeah. that's just simply my worldview. I intellectualize things probably a little bit more than I should. But as a psychological scientist, I just like to interrogate my own experiences. I see myself basically as a subject in my own right, and I try to get a handle on why I am going through or experiencing the types of emotions that I am. And in this case, it just simply happened to be suicidal feelings, you know, this sort of what I call in the book, this call to oblivion, mm-hmm. you know, this sort of seeking of quiescence or quietude of these raging thoughts. And for me, you know, a lot of it had to do with, you know, I'm relatively young at least at the time I was writing the book. I was, you know, in my early 40s and just thinking of, you know, the 40 years to come and what I was going to do with myself. At that point, I was quite unsettled professionally in terms of having a stable career and a salary and all those types of things. And it was worrisome. And I just kind of wanted to... I wanted to sleep. I wanted to put those thoughts to rest, this sort of constant rumination and worry and anxiety. And the only way I could cope with that, really, as a psychologist, was to put that under the microscope and really tease apart what underlied these dark feelings.
Yeah. There could be a risk of, you say, seeing this approach as in some way coldly scientific, but... In fact, you really do believe that science is the best way to keep people alive. And so the science part is really crucial for you.
It is. You can't fix what you don't understand. I think, you know, we really need to dig more deeply into the mechanisms, the psychological and cognitive mechanisms of suicidal ideation to be able to get that perspective that allows us to intervene and actually implement changes. I think that we have so far been so cautious and so scared of suicide, and rightly so. I mean, it's a devastating situation. But as a consequence of that, I think that we've kind of steered away from an objective analysis of why people are feeling this way. In favor of a just sort of a suicide prevention model that highlights pathology.
Yeah.
For me, suicidal thinking is actually quite a normal consequence of the human experience. And that's controversial in its own right. But, you know, I think the data actually bear that out, that the majority of individuals have experienced some type of suicidal thinking in the past. I mean, that doesn't obviously escalate to suicide. In fact, only a minority of people ever actually end their lives. But suicidal thinking is actually not as uncommon as we like to think.
Yeah. You say this is for the everyday person who considers all of this. I mean, you say we lock our doors before bed, we strap on seatbelts, but we're far more likely to perish by our own hands than die of outside causes. That's something that I guess a lot of us don't really think about.
That's right. Statistically speaking, I mean, we're much more likely to harm ourselves than other people harming us.
This was interesting. You write in the book that you were wanting to, this is how you put it, reveal the psychological secrets of suicide. interesting way to put it, and I wanted to ask you about that. The idea that the tricks our minds play on us when we're in this vulnerable state. Talk a little bit about that, because it's like this idea of there being this kind of hypnotic spell going on, these mind tricks that are going on.
Right. So this idea that we're sort of easy emotional prey to our own desires to put ourselves to rest, basically. And the idea is essentially that when we are feeling suicidal, our minds are vulnerable or subject to all sorts of cognitive distortions that impair our long-term decision-making. So we kind of get sucked into this trance of illogical thinking when we are emotionally overwhelmed with thoughts of our own death. So, for example, when one is escalating in suicidal thinking and they're in this state, their perception of time is warped. Basically, it feels like you're in this acutely bored state and the passage of time feels sluggish and elongated. It feels like it's just sort of dripping by. And that's a phenomenon, cognitively speaking, that people who have genuinely been suicidal report as a very, you know, a real but subjective phenomenon. It feels like time is just kind of crawling by. It feels interminable, insufferably long. And for me, you know, because I've had these recurring bouts of suicidal thinking since I was a teenager, I vividly recall these moments. You know, it just felt like I remember when I was about 18 or 19, and I, you know, at that time I had different types of drama than I did later in my life in terms of my career. But at that time, you know, I was gay. I was coming out of the closet. I wasn't quite ready to come out of the closet. There were situations that felt like I was going to be forced out of the closet, and I just remember thinking that God, it feels like I would do anything to, you know, become middle-aged or older right now. It just feels like the distance between being a teenager and being somebody that's like my grandparents' age, it felt like an infinity. And it felt like every day lasted forever. This resonated with me quite deeply, this sort of cognitive distortion of the passage of time. So that's what I meant by these sort of tricks that the mind plays on one that are... When we are genuinely suicidal and we're ruminating about death, our minds operate differently and our thinking is impaired.
I wanted to ask you, there's a section in the book where you sort of get at this question that a lot of people ask, and that is, do other creatures, do other animals contemplate or try to end their lives themselves? And it gets to this really interesting idea of how humans are distinct in the way we think. That this thing that other creatures, we have something that other creatures don't have. First of all, you reject the idea that in some ways other creatures don't have inner lives or have a sense of consciousness or emotions. And in fact, yes, they do suffer. You concede all of that. But what they don't have, you write about, is this unique concern that we seem to have about others judging us, or a sense of shame, this really distinctive thing to not only wonder what others are thinking, but wonder what others are, you know, thinking about us. Talk about this, because this seems really like a critical distinction.
So, as you said, I would certainly argue vehemently that other animals have deep emotional lives and that they feel very deeply and that their subjective phenomenological experiences are just as complicated and complex as humans are. But it seems to be, based on the comparative psychological evidence at least, that human beings are fundamentally unique in our preoccupation or our concern about other minds. We've been called the natural psychologist of the animal kingdom. We are constantly thinking about what others are thinking. And as you said, that sometimes means to our detriment, that we are worried or thinking about what others are thinking about us. This is called in technical sort of scientific parlance, it's called a theory of mind. If I'm on the street and I see, you know, 100 people surrounding me and walking down the sidewalk, all I'm you know, seeing perceptually in terms of what's in front of me, our bodies approaching me and moving in different ways and so on. I'm just seeing these sort of animate objects. But because I have a theory of mind, I'm also thinking about what's happening behind the scenes. I'm thinking about their mental states. And this ability to sort of envision, to take other people's perspective or step into other people's shoes engendered something fundamentally unique to human beings, and this is the experience of shame, because when we take the perspective of somebody else, oftentimes we think about what they're thinking about us, and that is incredibly painful. And this is a type of pain, I posit in the book, is responsible for the lion's share of suicidality in the human species. This worry, this preoccupation, this concern about what others think about us. And if that is a uniquely human experience, phenomenologically, this goes some distance in explaining why suicide has only really been observed in our species.
Yeah.
To me, that's an incredible thing if you think about it. You know, if you think about our closest living relatives, chimpanzees, there's been the equivalent of hundreds of years worth of ethological research in the field of primatology studying chimpanzees. You know, even if you include Jane Goodall's vivid anecdotes, not once has there been a clear-cut case of a chimpanzee, for instance, climbing to the highest branch it can find and jumping and deliberately ending its life. Do they get sad? Do they die of grief? Absolutely. But in terms of the intentional ending of one's own life, that seems to be something that is human. It's fundamentally human. Mm. We are the ape that jumps. That's what I say in the book.
Yeah. Well, this seemed like, to me, a really crucial insight that, as you put it, mental illness doesn't alone cause suicide. It's being aware that you're mentally ill and believing that others are judging you based on that. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that makes people vulnerable.
Yeah, mental illness in and of itself, if it's advanced and there's delusional or hallucinatory types of thought, doesn't necessarily make you vulnerable to suicide. It's that sort of juxtaposition of the sort of awareness that you are different than others and others know that you have this impairment that puts you at risk for suicide. That's something of a puzzle or something that doesn't make a lot of sense unless you look at it through the lens of this theory of mind argument.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the work of Roy Baumeister, this psychologist from Florida State, because one of the things you've said is you don't think any scholar ever has captured the suicidal mind better than he has. And I wanted to work through some of these steps and this theory that he's come up with. Talk a little bit about his steps. I think steps is a good word because it seems like in some ways, while they don't really go in order, there's a kind of sequence at least according to Baumeister, that you go through, that the suicidal mind mm-hmm. goes through.
Yeah, every case obviously is going to be different. As I say in the book, you know, it's been described as sort of dizzying in its variety in terms of the particular reasons for any given suicide. But Baumeister imposes a sort of framework that, to me, makes a lot of sense, at least looking at my own experiences as a suicidal person at one point. And he calls this the escape from self model. So basically, his argument is that suicide is motivated or precipitated by this sort of compulsion or this urge to avoid consciousness. And there are multiple ways to do that without taking one's own life. You know, there's sleep, which is a very common symptom of depression in terms of this sort of chronic fatigue. We just want to sort of shut off. There's drug and alcohol use, which similarly means this sort of escape from the self. But death is really the only sort of permanent way to escape the self, sadly. And to me, this made a lot of sense that suicide was not about some sort of, as psychoanalysts had said in the past, it's not some sort of like execution of the self because we're feeling guilt or anything along those lines. It's more about seeking quiet for these restless, anxious, worrisome thoughts that plague us 24 hours a day. So he's got this sort of model that is meant to be seen as sort of a series of progressive steps. And the point is that if you can kind of have this meta-awareness of these steps as they're happening, you can actually consciously intervene and recognize what's happening to you and just kind of step aside and let it pass without getting too absorbed into the process itself. So just for example, you know, his first step is basically that the self falls short of expectations,
right,
that something has gone wrong with our, at least in our own sort of self-narrative, something has gone wrong with the way that our story was supposed to unfold, and we're deeply disappointed. Yeah, so in Australia, New Zealand, I live in New Zealand, and rugby is a big thing here, but I think this is true for any professional sport. There have been a lot of stories in the news recently where there have been suicides of professional athletes that have, you know, recently retired from the game. And it's basically like this sort of dramatic shift between what one was recently to what they are now, this sort of shift or abrupt transition to this pedestrian life after being in the spotlight for so many years and being the center of attention. And if you find yourself now just kind of in a very quiet day-to-day routine. And this is something that some sports psychologists have said is a plague in the sense of former athletes not being prepared. But the same can be said, of course, for any person where you've got this sort of loss of status, basically. Yeah. So the suicide peak in fairly expected places, like when you're the suicide rate in the case of imprisonment is in that first month of incarceration, where you go from being a free person to that sort of reputational loss and being deprived of freedom and liberty and being separated from your family. It's that the highest risk of suicide is in that first month. Mm. The same thing is true for people that are institutionalized in mental health facilities or being divorced. The rate of suicide is much higher among the recently separated. The suicide is not especially high among people that have always been single. It's where you were married and now you're divorced, where you sort of you find that sort of gap, that transition in terms of your identity, that loss of identity, where you're most at risk.
Yeah. And then you mentioned stage two is when you blame yourself for all of that. It's the attributions to self.
Right.
And we hate ourselves because we've gotten ourselves into this situation.
Right. So we do know from suicide research that there are individual differences in people's proneness to suicidal thinking. And one of the best predictors is shame proneness, or this tendency to blame the self for problems. You know, you see yourself as being the responsible agent for the dilemma that you're in right now. You hate yourself, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
This sort of loathing of the self is one of the most ubiquitous, cross-culturally recurrent predictors of suicidal thinking. And so, you know, it's kind of ironic because people that are misanthropic, or they're not big fans of humanity in general, are protected from suicide. They've got this sort of buffer against suicidal thinking because they see the other people as being just as bad as they are.
Yeah.
But the suicidal person sort of elevates or puts on a pedestal other people and sees themselves as being somehow fundamentally flawed when everybody else is perfect and great. And they had this sort of idealized notion of the rest of the species. One of the interesting things that I came across in researching for the book was that narcissists and sociopaths are actually at a reduced risk of suicidal thinking. And to me, that simply means that they don't experience as deeply that sort of emotion of shame and guilt and sort of self-attributions of responsibility for the dilemmas that they're in.
Yeah. It gets us to what you describe as maybe the heart of Baumeister's theory, and that is this really hyper, unpleasantly sharp self-awareness, I guess is how you describe it. Like the want to get, just escape, that sense of you're so self-aware, so self-loathing, you just want to get out of it. And suicide is part of the attempt to do that, I guess.
Yeah, it's this excruciating self-consciousness. It's a desire just to stop thinking. And as I said earlier, you know, there are multiple ways to do that. And if all else fails, I think, you know, people oftentimes resort to suicide as a sort of dramatic, drastic attempt to put these intolerable thoughts to rest. I think escapism is a defense strategy. And this is oftentimes somewhat difficult for people to understand when you think about like young people or people in high school or university. They're oftentimes, you know, preoccupied with their studies, but this is simply because they are trying to distract themselves from all these other thoughts. I remember being this, you know, ravenous reader when I was 18, 19, 20 years old. I would read absolutely everything, but the only reason I was doing that was to sort of use other people's thoughts as a glove to cover my own thoughts. I wanted to be in the minds of somebody else rather than my own mind. And I don't know if it worked for me in the sense that I'm still alive, but it wasn't necessarily a healthy state of mind for me at that time. It was just simply something that I felt compelled to do.
You mentioned another one of Baumeister's ideas. You were talking about it earlier, this cognitive deconstruction where time seems to this warped sense of time. Time crawls, time slows down. I want to talk about stage six, which will get us to this other part of the conversation in the program, which is disinhibition. And you mentioned something that the poet Robert Lowell mentioned, that if we all came with this kill switch embedded in our, you know, in our arms, and if you flicked it, you'd just die, that we would have all flipped that switch a long time ago. And then this is what you write in the book. You say, that's the reason I don't keep a gun in my house. Talk about this part, because I think this is important too.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would have flicked that switch. I probably wouldn't have even made it to my teen years looking back. And I just think that when we are, first of all, I think that everybody is susceptible or vulnerable to suicidal thinking given the right social conditions. And I use the word right here only in the mechanistic sense that, you know, life throws us all sorts of unexpected challenges and situations that put us into a very dark place. And why give yourself such an easy outlet to this escape when, you know, we can sort of look at this preemptively and avoid it if we can? Gun ownership, obviously, is a major issue in the United States in particular. Right. And also, it's the leading cause of suicide in terms of the actual method of suicide that's used. So I would definitely recommend anybody who has been depressed or is prone to suicidal thinking not to keep a gun in their house, only because the escape route is just all too easy when you know you have that in your drawer. But, you know, also I think others should just, you know, even if you haven't experienced this yet, just to be cognizant of the fact that you might, you know, you're a human being. You're not immune to dark thoughts.
You write that controlling access to the means of suicide has an actual demonstrable effect on suicide prevention. And there are some fascinating examples of this, the Inuit community, and then a Canadian Arctic. Would you talk about that one?
Right. So there was a small community where there was a very high rate of adolescent suicide, especially young teenage males who were hanging themselves in their bedroom closets. And somebody had the idea of just simply, well, what if we removed the closet rods in all new builds of homes in this area? And it sounded like such a simplistic idea that it couldn't possibly be that straightforward. But in fact, the rate of suicide dramatically decreased among that demographic in that community simply by just taking out the closet rods. And other data support that idea that, you know, if we remove the easily accessible method of suicide or the preferred choice of suicide, the suicide rate actually meaningfully decreases. Mm-hmm. Here in New Zealand, for instance, in the town where I live, there was a sort of a suicide hotspot where people would jump off this cliff into the ocean. And every time the newspaper would report a story about exactly where the location was, you would find this sort of copycat effect and you would see a spike for a while. But the local government decided to put a roadblock about a mile away from the access to this point. So rather than just simply driving up this road and parking at the precipice to the cliff and jumping, people now had to park a mile away and walk to that point. Mm-hmm. And we've seen the suicide rate in this city go down because of that.
Yeah.
Just simply, you know, having to walk and think actually has an effect on those impulsive suicides. It's not just simply that they try to find a different spot and jump. It actually had an effect just on this particular geographic location.
One psychologist you mentioned said that many young suicide attempters report they only spent minutes between the decision and the actual attempt. And you also mentioned that suicidal ideation rarely lasts longer than 24 hours. So it seems like if you can sort of make it, as you put it in the book, make it a pain for people to die by their first choice, they don't necessarily
make it
find
difficult or pain in the ass, just kind of
right.
do what they want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think so those sort of blocking access to means is most effective for these impulsive types of suicides. That does characterize many young people's suicides where there's not a lot of planning involved.
Yeah. It doesn't get us to everything, of course, as you mentioned in the book. But I wanted to ask you finally, you say that we're better equipped to face all of these things if we just remain aware that we are, as you put it, social animals. Talk a little bit about that. It's this kind of recognition that we are who we are. This is who we are. This is our perspective. We're these social creatures. And if maybe that kind of awareness could be helpful, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. If we really want to sort of sabotage our own self-destructive thoughts, we've got to really look under the hood mm-hmm. and see how we are built as social animals to resort to this this terrible act. And having that sort of perspective where we can see ourselves as specimens, our own life stories, and if we can just step aside and recognize what's happening, when it's happening, and that actually this is not as abnormal as it might seem, and take away all that sort of moralistic judgment, mm-hmm. we're better equipped to let it pass and ultimately survive.
That's Jesse Baring. He's the director at the Center for Science Communication at the University of Otago in Dunedin in New Zealand's South Island. His new book is called Suicidal: Why We Kill Ourselves. We should point out that if you or someone you know is in need of help, we have a list of resources on our website. There are national and local crisis numbers, including the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And you can text that lifeline at 741-741. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about suicide. The research scientist and writer Jesse Baring joined us to talk about the science that helps explain why someone would contemplate taking their own life. And in his book, he mentions statistics that show more people die from suicides by firearms than homicides. And in some cases, nearly twice as many. In Utah, it's even more stark. When it comes to guns, suicides outnumber homicides in this state 8-1. Recently, a research team at Harvard released a study about firearm suicide in Utah. The findings and the effort to deal with the number of firearm suicides brought together two people who probably don't agree on much, not politically, not on the issue of gun control or gun rights. But Clark Aposhian, a gun rights advocate, and Marissa Sobelson-Henn, part of that research team in the Harvard study, are now working together on a public information campaign to get guns out of the hands of people who are thinking about ending their lives. Aposhian is the chairman of the Utah Shooting Sports Council. Dr. Sobelson-Henn is director of community health programs at Intermountain Healthcare, and they joined us in the studio. How did you guys meet? I have to say, just on the – this is you don't seem like you'd naturally align. Let's put it that way. So how did you connect up? Tell the story.
I'll give my impression. We were forced via legislation to meet. I mean, quite honestly, Representative Eliason, he started this about 6 years ago, and I first met her through Kathy Barber.
Yeah, probably. Kathy Barber is a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, and she said, you've got to meet Clark. So I think we set up a chance to grab burgers and started discovering that despite our differences, you know, I'm coming from Boston area, liberal background, healthcare, and Clark being the lead gun lobbyist for the state of Utah, we discovered we had so much in common and we liked hanging out. And so I think the next hang was at a shooting range. I said to Clark, you know, I'd really love to...
Had you been before?
No. I mean, I grew up in New Hampshire, so yeah. Definitely a state with a strong Second Amendment community, but no.
So you were familiar with the sentiment, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I knew that there's always more to people than meets the surface, and that was clear when I met Clark, that we had a lot in common. We started talking politics. We realized how much we enjoyed some of the same activities and had some similar values, but it wasn't until we went to the shooting range that I think the trust really... cemented, would you say so, Clark?
Absolutely, because I decided, you know, here we have a liberal from the East Coast that wants to go shooting, or at least has accepted the offer to go shooting. And I am going to bring not just you start out generally with 22 caliber rifles or something like that. I think we might have brought a 22, but we brought everything up to and including a machine gun and a 50 caliber Desert Eagle and to her credit, she didn't flinch, and she picked up every. You didn't not shoot one of those. Every one of those you shot.
Yeah, it was a different kind of experience. I'm not sure I've done it since, but certainly the work and the trusting relationship has continued since.
It made a lot of difference. It made a lot of difference for me and for everyone that I told about too.
Is that part of the problem in some ways of getting this word out or any other word out is that lack of trust, that because your values are different, you believe in different things in some ways, people just don't get together and talk about this stuff in the first place.
It is huge. Trust is in all caps. It's got to be. And it's not actually that we have different values. We come together on the things that we agree on. We love people. We want our friends and our family and our coworkers and our neighbors to continue their way of life, continue living. And to that end, we can agree on this. And it's trust that we're going to leave all that hyperbole at the door. We're going to leave all this stuff, but accept the fact that we do have differences.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I came to recognize quickly was that regardless of our backgrounds and our politics, both of us and the communities that we're a part of, the coalitions we're a part of, are completely outraged about the fact that 85% of gun deaths in the state of Utah are suicides. And half of those suicides are by firearm. And so it was Clark who knew those statistics before I did. And so as we dug into this issue and looked for opportunities to work together, it was really around that common goal, which is that no person in suicidal crisis should have access to a firearm, period. And that is a value that builds on values of responsible firearm handling, on values of protecting one's family that we share in healthcare, in public health, and in gun ownership.
Clark, one of the things you'd mentioned, I read where you had talked about how if somebody presents to you a study from back east, especially Harvard, that you're going to be pretty skittish about it and probably pretty skeptical about it.
Indeed. I mean, we have been conditioned. When I say we, I'm talking about the gun-owning public.
Yeah.
Not just in Utah, but everywhere. We've been conditioned by sad experience to be very distrustful, to be very suspicious of government involvement, of non-gun owners coming up with legislation that affects us. And what happens with that lack of trust, and some of it is well deserved, is that we miss out on understanding or accepting actual data that is there that we could act on. The other sad fact is that we've had our heads in the sand for quite a while with regards to suicide. Because if we are to accept the fact that our guns that we love, that we cherish, that we collect, that have been handed down, that we use for self-defense and hunting and family enjoyment and that, are the cause of death in so many Utahns and so many Americans, then that automatically means we have to do something about it. And it's imperative upon us to do something about it. And a lot of us just don't want to accept that fact that, yeah, these are guns that we've had for so long and are the source of so much joy, but then also the source of so much heartbreak.
Why doesn't the gun-owning community, or why has it been reluctant to see that? Is it because there's this presumption that if you concede on this point, perhaps they'll take the guns away or they'll limit access to guns? I mean, what is the reluctance?
But I think it's even deeper than that, in that the media, our legislators, our politicians, those folks that do have this information would rather, quite honestly, talk about those 30 to now coming up on 40,000 gun deaths, the vast majority of which are suicides. They don't want to talk about the suicides. They'd rather use that number to excite people to action, to ban AR-15s or to ban handguns or to ban concealed carry, which has nothing at all to do with suicides.
Marissa, I wanted to ask you, where does Utah fit in the scheme of things? You made some reference there before. We have the fifth highest suicide rate in the U.S. right now. 85%?
Yeah, 80, might even be about 86 now. 86% of gun deaths are suicides. And so, you know, one thing, many people are aware that Utah's suicide rate is high. It's interesting to note that Utah's suicide rate is very similar to other states in the Intermountain West, for this very reason, that the issue of firearms and the issue of suicide are inseparable. And so... one of the things that we really think about here is that suicide, as we just heard from Jesse in his incredible book, is so complex. And understanding the why of it is something we all must dedicate ourselves to and we can wrestle with. But as public health practitioners, and I count Clark in that camp, we have to focus on what we can do. And for that, it's not so much a question of why as much as it is a question of how. And these lethal means reduction strategies have been proven internationally, so many examples, some of which you've mentioned, to dramatically and effectively reduce risk. And so it's interesting to me that that hasn't been taken up as much, not just in Utah, but in the United States as a whole. And it's such a crucial window of opportunity.
Well, it mentions the really unique Inuit community, the fact just to remove these closet hangers is one aspect. I've heard catalytic converters. You remove catalytic converters, and they all. I don't know if this was in Europe, but they really made this idea of ending your own life in a closed garage with a running vehicle obsolete as an option.
Right. I mean, one of the examples I think is probably closest to what we're experimenting with here in Utah is the Israeli Defense Force. So in Israel, mandated military service, and they found that a lot of service people were dying on the weekends. And so they instituted one small policy, which was that soldiers could not bring their rifles home on the weekends. And just that change led to a 40% reduction in suicides. So that's what we're talking about. It's about putting time and distance between people going through a job loss, a breakup, a rough stretch, and saying we can't have access to a locked gun, to an unlocked or loaded gun during that time. So it's about temporary removal that respects rights, but that creates that safe distance. It's no different than when we think about, you know, drivers and cars. You know, it wasn't until we started focusing on the safety of roads and vehicles and less on the sort of skills of the individual driver that we began to see a rapid decline in motor vehicle accidents. It's sort of basic public health blueprint.
One thing that stood out to me was a CDC study that found people without a known mental health condition were nearly twice as likely to die by firearm suicide than any other method. What do you make of that?
No, and we found very similar evidence here in Utah that people who die by firearm suicide, we try not to use the word impulsive. It sometimes is a little bit seen as a bit disrespectful to people who are going through that level of despair. But there's something unpredictable.
And it's overly simplistic.
One of the things that stuck out to me from research that the Harvard School of Public Health just did here in Utah, requested by the Utah State Legislature, was we found that relationship issues were extremely common. About half of suicides involved a sort of relationship issue. One third of gun suicides happened in the midst of an argument. So it's almost like reshaping the issue as not necessarily as tightly correlated with mental illness as it is with the experience of a life crisis. And so then the question becomes, how can we give people skills and safety measures to get through that fluid risk that Jesse talked about, those periods of acute vulnerability, and go on to live lives of safety and of healing? Because we know so many people do recover, so many people get help, and over 90% of people who survive a suicide attempt will never go on to die by suicide. So saving a life now is saving a life usually forever.
But would you both talk about one pretty powerful PSA that you've been promoting? And this is a gentleman on a shooting range. Set this up for us. I want you to both sort of talk a little bit about this. Marissa, you start.
So I believe this was actually an idea that Clark had. And the concept is that people need to hear from gun owners themselves about the fact that, as Jesse mentioned, that there's a universality of this experience of ideation. Many people go through periods. And so in the video, the gentleman is at a shooting range and he pauses and looks at the camera and says, you know, a little while ago, I was going through a really tough time and my buddies recognize this and they offered to babysit my guns. And then he says, and I think they may have saved my life. And then he goes back to shooting. And I think the message here is that there's a dignity in what is presented. There's a respect for rights. And there's a message of hope and recovery, that he's back to his hobby that he loves.
Yeah, what we had hoped to do with that one is relate kind of – it's a teaching strategy. Mm-hmm. Relate the known to the unknown. Mm-hmm. And in a way, we all know that, you know, if somebody's drunk at your house at a party or at the bar or whatever, you're not going to let them drive home.
Yeah.
You're going to find anything you can. You're going to take the keys. You're going to give them a ride. You're going to call an Uber, whatever it is. And that's basically – but you're not going to inform the police that you've taken their car. You're not going to say they tried to get into the car. You're not going to do it. You're just going to hold the keys, and you kind of have a little contract there. You're not going to go joyriding in their car. You're going to give it back to them when they sober up or when they tell you they want their keys back. And it's appropriate. Not only is it appropriate, it's expected now to do that. What we'd like to do is get that so commonplace, take the stigma away from – you know, having your keys taken away from you by your buddy, and get that stigma that it's not a mental health type thing always. It's because we're human that we're going to get angry, we're going to get sad, we're going to get happy, we're going to get depressed. It's a human condition, and there are some things that we can do as family and friends. One of the things that would choose to us in that is that I think it was Kathy Barber that told me, only 6% of suicides are with firearms that were recently purchased. So these are folks that have lived their whole life with a firearm, or, you know, at some point they've had this firearm and used it for recreational purposes or hunting or self-defense, and then something happened in their life that changed it, and that firearm now became the means to which they ended their life.
Is this a tough sell? Has it been to the gun-owning community?
Yes.
Yeah.
By and large, I think it's kind of – we see the gun-owning community breathing a sigh of relief, because this is something that has been in the back of their minds for so long, because everybody has an example. Everybody has a story, and now they're able to say, oh, other people are feeling the same way that I'm feeling. I'm not alone. It's you know, the gun right group are talking about this. It's okay to let your guard down a little bit now.
Are you seeing, Marissa, are you seeing breakthroughs then with the community?
Yeah, I mean, it's been – I feel lucky. I feel lucky that Clark has been able to make introductions to gun advocates of many different stripes.
You sort of needed that, didn't you? Someone to sort of – come on in.
Somehow an email from at harvard.edu was not going to make it. But Clark is constantly able to give me, you know, red line edits on practice language, on ways of messaging, that we in health bring certain skills, but we're not the best messengers. We need others to contribute that expertise and to help create these new norms of safety. So I'm grateful. It could not happen with just one group or the other. We need to constantly work in coalition.
So it sounds like the people in your community, Marissa, are learning.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about the people in your community. Are they learning as well from being more willing, perhaps, to listen to?
They absolutely are. Yeah. In fact, I think just my own board is a good example. I was extremely apprehensive after a meeting 6 years ago with Representative Steve Elison, in which he provided some facts to me, and I went back and I researched the heck out of him and found that these were accurate. The numbers, we had 572 gun deaths in Utah, and 87% of those were suicides. Now, nobody had ever told us that before. And there were some ideas that Representative Elison had, creating studies, creating partnerships, and which is the one partnership that brought Marissa and I together. And I didn't really want to go to the board with this because I knew the board. And so I brought one more board member on. And I had a one-on-one, and we talked, and then we decided, okay, we're going to go present this to our board. And we both actually believed the real possibility that we were going to be removed at the end of that meeting.
Wow.
And we weren't. And the board is now understood, and the data, and they're behind us, and they support us in this effort.
It says a lot, right?
Yeah. I mean, it really requires all of us, I think, moving outside of our comfort zones and recognizing that the other person, the other group's values and perspectives on this issue matter if we're going to drive change. Because ultimately, this isn't just about, you know, it is feel good in an era of divisiveness. It feels nice to be able to cross the aisle. But much more importantly, if we're going to see meaningful reductions in the suicide rate so that Utah is no longer, you know, framed as this high suicide state, this is, I think, how we're going to do it. Mental health, screening, these things matter. But when it comes to what makes us an outlier, it's going to be addressing lethal means.
Dr. Marissa Sobelson-Henn is the Director of Community Health Programs at Intermountain Healthcare. Clark Aposhian is the chairman of the Utah Shooting Sports Council. That's a gun rights lobbying group. I should mention again that if you or someone you know is in need of help, we have a list of resources on our website. There are national and local crisis numbers, including the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 1-800-273-8255, or you can text the Lifeline at 741-741. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.